You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I remember walking around the court square sidewalks, looking in.
It's going to be Gunner's walk-up music from now on. This is him right here. That's right. Alan Jackson just walking around downtown Granbury, Texas. Just being a guy. So what's going on, man? How are you?
Good.
What's going on? Tell me what's shaking in Granbury, Texas today, this week. Is there a big fall festival?
Yep, we have a big fall festival coming this weekend.
All right, and are you going to it? Well, you got to go to it, right? Everybody going to be down there.
Yeah. I'll go by there, but I don't know if I'll stay down there. We're gonna have a brisket barbecue stuff at the ranch house, I think, this weekend. So last night we did some campaigning. We were in Toller, which is another city right next to us.
Nice. So, what kind of campaigner are you? What kind of campaign did you go door to door? Was it a debate or what?
A town meet and greet.
A town meet and greet. So all the candidates were there.
No, this is just a meet and greet for Ron.
Okay. Oh, just for him. So was it well attended? Were you pleased?
It was a big turnout. Yeah.
As the Karl Rove of Granbury, Texas, were you pleased?
Yes, I was very pleased.
All right. Would you think you'll win the election?
Yeah, I mean, he's really the number one candidate, you know, for kind of what fiscal responsibility is, you know, the message is we're paying taxes. We want to make sure that the taxpayers are well represented within the county and the tax dollars are going to, you know, what they believe is the right way to go. So spend money. When you're going to spend money, make sure you're responsible spending money as a political candidate.
You know, it's the easiest thing in the world to do is to spend somebody else's money. And as we see federally and all over the nation, there's never a shortage of great ideas. Honestly, there's never a shortage of great ideas and doing other things for other people that are less fortunate, that don't sound great. And
right.
The hard part is, what do you want me not to do in order to do that? That's the hard part. And, you know, the more I watch government, I honestly, one of the things I struggle with relative to with liberals is, where does the money come from that keeps us all from winding up like Illinois? And I'm a little bit disturbed by that. I'm a little bit disturbed about the future of the nation, honestly. But I was in a in 2006 when I ran for office when I was in Iraq, and I wasn't supposed to, but I didn't know that. They say, hey, we're having a debate here, and. And so what happened was, I just listened by phone. There was four other candidates running, for, you know, the city council seat that I was running for. So, you know, they'd go around and ask questions. And so one of the questions they asked was, you know, if you're elected, you know, how green will you be, you know? So everybody wants to be green, right, Mike?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I went last, and everybody's talking about, oh, I want to do this, and I want to do this. And I said, you know what, Earth is my, of all the planets I've ever lived on, Earth's my favorite, personally. And I love being green. Okay? But do you know that it costs us money to recycle? We pay to do that. That program doesn't pay for itself because, you know, we have to move all that stuff, you know, to get it to places that deal with it. And it's not a moneymaker anymore because there's such an abundance of it around the nation. Didn't know that.
Right.
Okay, so do you want me to be green and not do things in the schools? Should I be green there? Do you not, is there, if I'm going to be green, can I raise your taxes? Well, no. Okay, should I not fix the roads? Where does green fit in terms of this larger picture in our budget? And I made the other guys look like idiots, because they were, because it's like, it's this whole kumbaya thing. And so to me, this concept of limited government, that we're going to do this and we're going to cut this, is something that is not embraced enough around the nation. And at some point, you're going to pay the bills. And just watch Illinois and see what they're going through. Unfettered spending, irresponsible spending, and everything's good, to include providing daycare every day now for kids. You drop your kids before school. They get fed. They stay at school. They get fed. Then there's an after-school program, and they get a snack. So yeah. Now the county is now providing daycare for you because that's what you want. Is that what we can afford? So anyway, it's very interesting world that we live in, and the default position is more and more that, oh, well, you're supposed to provide that.
Sure.
Right. So anyway, what are the biggest issues in the election?
Well, like I just said, it's just, spending in the county and making sure that the tax dollars going to the right thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know what? When you said that, I pulled up Illinois, their state. And, when you look at everything across, you know, their population is 12 million people, 12.7 million people in the state of Illinois. Their unemployment is 287,000 and their food stamp recipients is almost 2 million. And then when you look at their GDP, their debt to GDP ratio is 17.3%, and their debt per citizen is $11,000 per citizen. So when you look at spending, it's $153 billion. Their revenue is $112 billion.
Amazing, isn't it?
It's just, oh.
You start breaking it down, and then you know, you go through, I just read an article yesterday that they thought they were $5.5 billion, you know, in current bills behind, and they were trying to pay them, yada, yada, yada. And then they found out that they had another $9.5 billion bills that hadn't even been submitted for consideration as they try to tunnel out of this hole. They hadn't passed the budget in, I want to say, 4 years or some nonsense. And just crazy. And then, you know, you just heard, General Dunford's speech, you know, his assumptions coming in operationally over the 4 years that I'm going to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, our tempo is going to slow down. It's increased, and we are going to get some relief from Congress and get out of this sequestration thing. There's been no relief.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, maybe they'll pass a budget this year. And at some point, something's got to break unless you begin to fund. And what we've done is we've gutted modernization in traded that for operational readiness. And so at some point it's going to be difficult unless Congress begins to fund the DOD as it should be funded. Because one of the things he said is, hey, look, when you look at the way we're constructed and the way we fight wars, right? War breaks out on Korea, right? That isn't going to involve you know, Korea, right? It's also going to involve Pacific Command because Japan's going to be involved in it. So it's going to be a regional war. And it's going to also involve NORTHCOM in the United States because they'll be involved too. We don't even have a command and control, you know, organization that accounts for that. And I thought, whoa. And he's just such a smart guy, and it's so refreshing to hear smart guys talking about hard subjects, whether it be city council stuff or whether it be DOD stuff, and knowing that we've got good guys there. Our problem is we don't have the right people in Congress. they don't have the right mentality, and I don't know how that changes, and so I guess we'll see. But you and I have talked about that before. But those issues are resident locally. People that like to spend money. I mean, I'll tell you what, and to me, there is nothing worse than the pensions that you see given out to police officers and firefighters that are $100,000 plus pensions.
Mm-hmm.
And how does a community, you know, continue to afford that kind of stuff? And the answer is it won't. At some point, it'll go belly up because there's just not the money to support that kind of stuff. And it's absolutely crazy, but it's the way it happens is politicians, Mike Musselman running for city council. I'm the head of the police union. I walked him up to him and I say, hey, Mike, you know, we'd love to support you. You know, you're a gun guy. You're a law and order guy, but here's what we want. We want you to take our percentage of retirement, you know, what we earn in retirement. We want you to take it from, 90 to 92%. And Mike says, is that all? We don't want anything else. That's it. 4 years later, they come back to Mike again and they say, hey, if you're going to run again, we want it from 92 to 94. You wonder how these numbers get so high? Because Mike doesn't want the cops and the fire guys going door to door saying, hey, Musselman, yeah, we know he served in the Marine Corps. He's not a cop and fire guy, though. Don't vote for him. What? But that's how this bullshit game gets played, and you wonder why you see these things. And if you don't have people that'll say no, then I guess you get what you get. But so anyway, interesting.
Yeah, no.
Has there been any surprises? Is there been any surprises for you, Mike? Because you've kind of this is the first time you've dabbled in politics, yes, in terms of being involved.
Yeah. Well, my biggest surprise is even small towns such as Granbury, the politics that go on are just it's disgusting. You know, that's some of the stuff that, you know, that we really need, that we really need to take care of is just overlooked. And then some of the other stuff, you know, so we were talking about yesterday, you know, way back when they were building a nuclear power plant out here, the county of Hood County voted against it to have it in the county. So then what it did is it basically moved just a couple miles outside of the county. And Somerville County, which was part of Glenrose, which was a city that used to be in Hood County, basically seceded from Hood County, created its own county, Somerville County, and Glenrose became the county seat. And then they brought the nuclear power plant in there. So it's literally right on our border, you know. And the tax revenue, the taxes from that would have benefited this county so much, you know. And because people were afraid of having nuclear power inside their county, and it's going to be built. And you know, the whole notion of, well, what happens if something goes wrong? Well, you got an island because it's built a couple miles away. You got now like 15 more seconds. So. Just not taking advantage. We have an industrial park that's never been developed. It was a promise to the county, the city. But, you know, the county's unwilling to fund a permanent fire department. We have an all-volunteer fire department here in the county. Doesn't want to pay the money. And I get it, but that comes with the growth of the county. You know, getting bigger, the city's getting bigger. At one point to bring in industries because of insurance payments and everything else, they want a stand-up fire department. So, yeah, I got it. It's gonna cost money to pay these guys, but then you're gonna bring in more money with revenue and more jobs and, you know, more corporation and taxes. They're just afraid to make those decisions.
Well, it's hard, right? I think everybody sees the right thing, but doing the right thing has political consequences, right, Mike?
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to the moral courage thing. You do what's right. It may not be popular, but it's what's right.
Right. And that's, again, and this is, you know, what you face as a politician. So I'm sitting with another city councilman in his office, and this police guy is sitting with us. And he looks at me and he says, if you won't agree to that, then we'll go door to door and fight you. And I said, okay, well, help me out then. How do I support it? If I'm a fiscal conservative, you want me to support $400,000 general fund increase to pay for your conversion from defined contribution, which is an IRA type plan, to a defined benefit plan, which is a military type retirement, right? You don't put anything into it. You serve, you get paid. So they wanted that to be converted. The cost is $400,000. What are you going to concede so that I can stand on that and say, look, we're going to pay this. They're going to give up this. It'll work. And he said nothing.
Well, they don't want it. They don't want concessions.
Yeah, nothing. I said, well,
want everything.
Yeah, do you want to open up labor? No, the mayor said he'll pay for it all. I said, yeah, well, I won't do that. And he said, then we'll campaign against you. And I said, so be it. And I lost. But you know what? I said, look, if I do that, I'm the same as everybody I talk about, I rail about.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when you see these things, you know, come up, I find it's really interesting because you know what the right thing to do is. The question, do you have the moral courage and will you take the political blowback that comes with trying to do the right thing? And, you know, it's that's what, you know, again, that's the whole point, I guess, when you take that nationally, when there is no middle ground anymore, how do you do it? I don't know.
Yeah.
And you know, again, I had somebody come on the program last week and said, hey, we just need to elect more veterans. And out of those veterans, we need to, you know, coalitions formed that will compromise. That will compromise. And they will stand up and say, look, I don't like this. I like this about 50%, but I'm voting for it because I think it's better than what we have today. And so I'll live with it, and then hopefully we'll make it better. And if right. both sides are saying that, then it's right. But it's interesting. The let me just read your email. Thanks, great content today. Thanks for hunting down the Mattis speech. I found the book on Amazon. Mattis talks about a book called This Kind of War by a guy named T.R. Fehrenbach. I will tell you, it's the best war book I've ever read. It deals with the Korean conflict. It deals with readiness during peacetime. The fact that the United States Marine Corps, for whatever reason, maintained its discipline post-World War II and was still a fighting force when it went to Korea and did good things. I watched a thing over the weekend, Mike, called Bloody George, and it had to do with George Golf Company 3-1.
Right.
Have you ever met any of those guys? That fought at the Chosin?
Well, yeah, I have, but not at three. I don't think I've met anything that was anybody from 3-1.
Yeah, if you see the geometry of the Chosin Reservoir and look where the units were, 5th Marines and 7th Marines are around the west side of the reservoir when they get hit. Them fighting simply to get back to the rest of the division is an incredible fight in and of itself. Let alone what they do, you know, to get back to the coast. And I watched the program over it. And those guys used to have, were you ever around those guys when they got together up at 29 Palms, Mike? Those 7th Marines guys that would show up and talk about the crazy stuff that they went through? Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. I got a gun question for you. Yeah. Mac, could you ask the gunner, I have a World War II Mauser, and I have a World War II M1 rifle. I would like to improve their sights. What is a way that I can improve their sights yet not detract from what they are relative to antique-type weapons?
Yeah. What kind of Mauser?
I don't know. I'll wait.
Part 98?
He says World War II. I would imagine it'd be your standard M1A1 Mauser.
Well, no, there's no such thing as that.
Well, you know what I mean, though.
If he's got a car and he wants to put an optic on it?
Something on the front side.
Well, okay, so you can, all of those guns have kits that you can retrofit them and make them more modern looking, but then you lose the value of right. What the gun really is. If we're talking about a car 98, that's the, you know, the Carabiner 98K, the German Mauser, the 7.92, what you do then is you can actually go and get, you know, the scopes that were found for it, you know, back in the day, they actually had them scopes, the mounts, and then the hooded front sight posts. But if you're going to completely convert it to something that you don't care about the historical value to it, then yeah, there's kits out there you can retrofit, you know, do some stuff with that. So,
all right, that would be the best bet.
Yeah, if that's what you're looking for, I would never. I wouldn't do it. I mean, I like the way they look.
Yeah, I would too. I don't know. Yeah, they're such historic pieces. Don't screw with them because they look awesome. You know, that's my opinion. I had a friend of mine's father, a friend of mine from North Dakota, his grandfather grew up in Poland, and at 16 joined the Polish resistance. At 17 was captured by the Germans, put in a concentration camp, escaped the concentration camp, you know, at like 18 or 17 and a half, gets recaptured when he's 19. They see the number that's already on his arm, and they said, oh, you've escaped? You'll go to Auschwitz then. So he went to Auschwitz, and he was a laborer at Auschwitz. He gets out, and his dad sent me a picture of, sends me a picture of, his dad, in a U.S. Army uniform, guarding prisoners. And he says, hey, Mac, do you know what kind of weapon this is? You know, is it a Springfield 1903? Because it's a bolt action weapon. And I'm thinking, Springfield 1903. And I'm not a gun guy. You know, I don't even participate in Mike's discussion, but I thought Springfield 1903 in 1946. Yeah, those things have all been given out. Okay. Those things are not around anymore. And I thought,
yeah, they are.
Well, but this is my line of thinking. So I say, I'm thinking that if that's a bolt action rifle in Germany post World War II, that's a Mauser. So I look at pictures, but it was really interesting, just the story of his grandfather. And absolutely mind-blowing what his grandfather went through and how his grandfather actually survived all of that. And they asked him after the war, do you want to guard German prisoners? He said, I will. And he said, will you have any compunction about killing them? Nope.
Yeah,
and then he winds up coming to. I thought he was coming to the United States. Winds up landed in Nova Scotia. Makes his way to Thunder Bay. Becomes a carpenter because that's what he did at Auschwitz, and raises his family in Thunder Bay. And his son was a great pitcher growing up, and pitched one of the Canadian teams to the Little League World Series. And the Twins wanted to fly him down to Florida for spring training, and he went to his dad and he said, "Hey, Dad, the Minnesota Twins want to fly me to Florida to try out for their baseball team." He said, my dad looked at me and said, there's no money in baseball. He said, you need to work. He said,
yeah.
And he said, that was it. That was the end of the discussion.
Yeah. Yeah, but on the you know, the Marines in Guadalcanal in the early parts of World War II used 1903.
Right.
The M1 Grands weren't available yet.
How late in the war did we use the O3? Did we just...
We used it all the way through the war, actually. And then the 1903 A3 came out, and that was just a more modern, more tight M1 Graham look to it with the sighting system and everything else. It had a very similar siren system. The A3 did, the 1903 A3. So it was really comparable to, if you've been trained on the M1 Grand, then the 1903 A3 was easy to use. But the 1903 saw combat in World War II all the way through.
Have you fired it?
Yeah. It's a great gun. They were used as sniper rifles in World War II. The A4 was basically your telescopic sight mounted bolt action gun. It was very accurate. It'd shoot forever.
Interesting. What kind of magazine did it have?
It had a 5-round internal magazine, so you pull the bolt back, had a 5-round clip, and you just slap them down in there like a Mauser.
And then does the clip eject at the end of the last round?
No, that's a grain. That's
like
a grain that you.
So what do you? How,
it was just on a stripper clip. Stripper clip.
Got it.
You put it in there and you push them all down in there and then toss the stripper clip.
Interesting. Here's an email for you.
Yeah.
I love gun talk, just so everybody knows. The more gun talk, the better. Does a gunner have a favorite rifle that he's ever fired, since we're talking about firing rifles? Yeah, Mike, you have a favorite rifle? When you like get your answer, you're like, oh boy, this could be fun.
No, not really. I mean, I like all of them. My favorite?
That's awesome. Let me just tell you, when I fired my M1 for the first time, I was like, holy shit, man. This is a rifle. First of all, the sound is so much different. And if you're going to suppress a target with a 7, with a 30-06 round, you fire that son of a bitch into the dirt in front of somebody, shit goes everywhere, man. That bigger round kicks up a lot of stuff. And
yeah.
I took it on the Ranger when we deployed. I threw it in the armory, and we had ammunition. So we would go back, we'd do these fam fires off the fantail. And, we'd be throwing garbage in the water and shooting at it. And then Marie's like, sir, can we bring the Grant? I'm like, yeah. Yeah, we can bring the Grand. And you'd all of a sudden you'd hit, the 5.56 round. Pop, pop, pop. And then you hear boom. And everybody's like, damn, nothing bad. It's loud. And there's no buffer in the stock, right? So you gotta be a man to fire it. But it's a
nice looking gun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a really good looking gun. I think Grand is pretty cool. I mean, I like the M14. Has that grand look to it.
What did they do different with the 14?
The M14?
Yeah.
It was a fully automatic.
Oh, I didn't know that.
20-round clip. Yeah.
20-round magazine with an automatic switch?
Yeah, it was nice.
Ooh.
Because the Grand fires 8 rounds. Has an 8-round clip.
Right. Which is not very many.
Yeah.
Not so, really. Wow.
No, and Grand would go through that pretty quick. And then you had that ting sound when you get to the last round and it checks the back plate.
When you're firing, it's pretty cool. Bing! And the clip goes up in the air. That's why I wondered if the Springfield had a similar mechanism that would allow it to be like that.
Yeah, it was a 5-round stripper clip. You just push the rounds in there. Well, the stripper clip didn't go on the gun.
Next question. I've never fired a Springfield. What kind of sight did it had? Typical iron.
Rear sight, peep sight. It was like a rear sight, round sight, and then a bladed post. Good gun. Real good gun. And there, the Grands are, you find them. There's a lot of them out there. And then you can find some other ones. I mean, Beretta made one in the 50s that, took off that, basically came off of that whole Grand look. And it's the Beretta 20-round magazine. It looks kind of like a M14, actually. But, yeah, pretty cool. then the Ruger Mini 14 was, you know, came off of them, the M14. So, yeah, cool.
Another
but now you can find grams in, you know, 308, and, you know, 30-06. So.
Interesting question. Is 30-06 ammunition and 7.62 ammunition interchangeable?
No. Not at all. So the 30-06 cartridge. So when we talk about NATO 308, you know, the first number is the caliber. So 7.62. A 30-06 is 7.62. Right?
Right.
It, and that's the diameter of the of the round.
Right.
So it's a, but a 30-06 is, it's 63 millimeter? Yeah, 63 millimeter. So it's a lot taller. When you put a 30-06 next to a 308, the 30-06 is going to stand much bigger. It's going to look a lot bigger round.
It's going to look taller.
Yeah.
Can it be, can it be fired through,
No, because the casing won't fit in either gun. So if you're firing a 30-06 and a 308, the back end of it's going to stick out.
Okay.
And if you're going to fire a 308 and a 30-06, it's not going to neck. It's not going to, the neck isn't going to seat in the chamber.
Got it. Mike, what's the system the Soviets use relative to our calibers? They have an 82-millimeter mortar that, in a pinch, they could fire our ammunition because it's always smaller than theirs, but we could never fire their ammunition out of our tube?
That's one of those things that they always say that, yeah, you know, they got an 82, we got an 81, they could fire an 81 out of an 82. I wouldn't do it.
Right.
Because you ballistics, you're not going to get that complete seal, that gas ring.
Right.
How does the
pin line up? If, you know, when you're dropping it down the tube, if it's not perfectly centered, how does the firing pin, would it still fire?
Centered. Yeah, it would fire. I mean, you could do it, you know, but, I would try it. I mean, cause you don't know, I mean, I don't know off the top of my head what the pressure at those things are rated, like an 82, you know, an 82 versus an 81, what the pressure differences are. So, you know, if the American 81 has a stronger pressure, so when you drop that down in a tube of an 82 and your tube isn't thick enough, the walls aren't thick enough, well, then you're going to get a rupture, and that's going to be the last round you ever drop.
Email FN-FAL or HK-91?
Thin-Fowl, they call them, Thin-Fowls.
Thin-Fowl or HK-91?
Thin-Fowl. I mean, they're very similar looking. I would tell you to go with the FN-FAL, Fabric National, you know, the Belgian gun.
Right.
And It's a we basically call them an elephant gun because when you fire it, it feels like you're hunting elephant.
Ah.
You get a lot of kick in those things. Well, the HK has a roller bolt design, so it's going to be less of a recoil, but it's still going to be a recoil. But I don't like the look of an HK. You know, like 93s and the 91s. Those are the old. They look very similar, but. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of those. People like them. I'm not a big fan of them. You know, so your HK-43, you know, so they're cool looking guns. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
But I'd go with the Thin-Fowl. They just look really cool. I love them. I fired a bunch. The Iraqis had a bunch of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, the problem with HKs is HKs, like the 93s, man, they can be expensive as hell. So, I mean, if you can find one, go for it. 93, and it's 93 fire stop by six, and the 91 fired the 7.62. But yeah, it's crazy, man. Go ahead.
Here's another. Mac, you were talking about that movie about the Army medic on Okinawa during World War II. One of my recollections from that movie, and correct me if I'm wrong, is soldiers taking mortar rounds, popping it on their helmet, and then firing it over a berm and it exploding. You know, I saw that, and I meant to note it. The email goes on, is that possible, Mike? Is that possible?
Yes. Yes. Back then, they didn't have, so like today, there's a pin on the side of the mortar round and the fuse that when it reaches, it's like a centrifugal safety. So when the round actually meets a certain velocity, that it's a setback pin, it pulls down, the centrifugal force of the mortar round being fired releases that pin and arms the fuse. And it takes a certain distance for that to happen. But in World War II, that was not the case. So basically you had a hand grenade. And all you had to do, and the arming device was on the back pin, so when you dropped down and it struck the plate, and when the propellant ignited, it pushed the mortar out. It was already armed at that point. As soon as it hit the back plate on when you slid it down.
Okay.
So it wasn't until modern day mortars where they actually have a centrifugal setback pin that when it reaches a certain velocity, it pulls that velocity pulls that spring loaded pin back down, causing the army pin to shoot out. And then it's armed. But yeah, it's basically it's a grenade, because the fuse, the switch on the top is just a button. You push it, and boom.
Wow. Here's one more, and then I'll let you go. Hey, Mac, there's a video that I've seen, and I'm not sure where it's from. I thought it was from Iraq, based on the time that I received it. But it's essentially a dude shooting a mortar in a handheld position. He's a bad guy. And you can hear the guys, you know, chanting Allah Akbar in the background. He drops a round down the tube and it explodes. I won't tell you my reaction to it. I'll tell you mine. I laugh my ass off, man. They're shooting at Americans, so screw them. So that's my reaction, because I've seen that video. How does that happen? Mike, how does that happen?
I cannot discuss that over the airwaves.
Oh.
That is classified. But that was a project that we were involved in, that they would use ammunition that was basically rigged. So that's as far as I can probably talk about.
Aubrey.
So yeah, that happened.
Aubrey Radio. You've obviously seen the video.
Oh yeah.
There you have it. There you have it, Mike Musselman. All right, man. Good luck with your political campaign.
Well, it's not mine. I'm just helping them.
No, but you're part of it, man. You're invested. So you're with your time and a little bit of your heart. So good luck to you with all of that. And Yankees get going here in about 3 hours. You fired up for that?
Yeah. Are they playing still in New York?
Yeah, they play 3 games in New York. Then they'll go back to Houston.
Yeah, wow. They better get their act together, man. Better not be like last night.
What do you mean?
I mean, in the first 2 games, I liked because they were close, man. They were nail biters.
Right.
You know, but, yeah, shit last night was a complete blowout.
Wow. All right. Yeah, that was a good thing. Yeah, that was a good thing. That was a good thing. You're acting like it was a bad thing. You're a Houston fan. You're a Red Sox fan, which means you're an American League East fan, which means you're now a Yankee fan. Get with the program. Get on board. Hello? Hello? What happened? He muted himself. He fell off the stool and he muted himself. All right, we'll let him go. That'll do it. This program repeats itself momentarily. And let me just tell you, if you're just tuning in, pretty cool stuff, huh? That's awesome. You'll get a chance to hear the Association of the United States Army held their big conference, trade show, convention, all that kind of stuff. The Secretary of Defense spoke. You'll hear him. And also the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff spoke. You'll hear him. I would tell you this. Whatever you do, don't touch your dial, because both speeches are great speeches. I would tell you in particular, listen to what the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has to say. I mean, truly enlightening relative to assumptions made when he came into his current job. And then beyond that, you know, assumptions he made coming into his job, that operational tempo at some point will slow down. It hasn't. It's only gotten higher. At some point, sequestration will go away, and we will get some financial relief. He's rejected that now. So, anyway, pretty interesting. But you'll hear much more, I mean, transformational in terms of where we are relative to Russia's use of cyber warfare, use of irregular forces to destabilize their former satellite Soviet republics, and then go in and either annex, whether in the case of the Crimea, or threaten the Ukraine, yada, yada, yada. China doing similar things, and then we will take all of this on simultaneously. So Joe Dunford, absolutely incredible. So don't touch that dial. Have a great day on a Tuesday. All Marine Radio, over and out.